Have you ever noticed how almost everything in life these days seems to be reduced to a form of entertainment or a form of public spectacle? Even things as nominally serious as politics are turned into a spectator sport, a kind of cheering game where, just like cheering on Manchester United or Arsenal or whoever your team happens to be, instead you're cheering on your political party or your favorite leader, whether it's Donald Trump or recently Andy Burnham in this country. Politics in itself becomes a kind of game. It becomes a kind of spectator sport. If people can remember back in the days of when Q was going on, their whole catchphrase was just sit back and enjoy the show. Get your popcorn out. And indeed, the experience of social media turns being involved, quote unquote, involved in politics into a kind of enjoyable entertainment activity like watching a sports event. Hence, people get excited to, quote, get out their popcorn as they watch various things unfurl. This covers everything from, day-to-day politics to really quite serious things such as war, where people are being bombed or getting their heads blown off, and yet it is still experienced as a spectacle, still experienced as entertainment. Now, the person who we're going to be talking about today, Guy Debord, really had this idea in his book, The Society of the Spectacle, which he wrote back in the 60s, saying that this is a feature of advanced capitalism, that everyday life is colonized by spectacle, which then contains even the possibility of resistance, because resistance itself becomes this kind of participatory spectator sport. That capitalism essentially reduces everything to the level of being a little guy in the crowd with his Hulk. Do you remember that Hulk Hogan finger? The Hulk Hogan finger, or the Red Devils Manchester United finger, or the Donald Trump finger. And everything is reduced to, yay, the spectacle. Everything from war to love to your own life to everything that you experience. In this video, I'm going to be talking you through exactly how Guy Debord explains all of this. Before I get going, I will remind people very quickly that I do sell courses here at the Academic Agency, courses on politics, on economics, on Shakespeare, on the classical trivium. You can get them all of my courses in one ultra bundle, or you can buy them individually. So you can browse that in your own time, buy it now, etc. Let's get on to Guy Debord. So the Society of the Spectacle is as follows. Modern capitalist society has entered a new stage in which authentic social life is increasingly replaced by its representation. So this is one of the, a couple of weeks back, I talked about the Marxist thinker Louis Althusser, who said ideology has a material existence. Well, Debord says that one of the kind of core strategies of capitalism is that it wants to reduce everything down to a game of representation. The spectacle is a total social relationship extending far beyond advertising or television, in which people relate to one another and to the world itself primarily through images and appearances rather than through direct experience. And one of the interesting games that you can play to just to see how true this is was imagine for a moment a world in which there was no longer any media or social media. right? The BBC just turned its lights off. The ITV and all of the, all in America, Fox and all, every single news channel just gone. If you turn on the television, nothing to watch. The internet is switched off. Okay. You've still got electricity. You've still got cars and, you know, you can still drive about. You've still got, you know, lots of other things, but there are no newspapers. There's no TV. There's no internet. I often had this thought, actually, and really it was the board who put this in my mind during the era of COVID-19, when there was the, you know, the pandemic that, you know, when we all had to walk around with our masks and we were shown images on the television of, I'll never forget it, lines and lines and lines of coffins in Italy. Anybody remember this? Or was it just my mind playing tricks on me? I still remember. Lines and lines of coffins in Italy. And people in white suits, as if they had gone to space, with, you know, almost like helmets on in China. They were wearing these kind of white full body suits, you know, like sterilizing the streets with some machine. And we were shown these images. And then we were shown these images of mass coffins in Italy. And we were told, this is coming here. This is big. This pandemic is going to hit us hard. And you're going to have to prepare for the new normal, right? Anybody remember all of this? Because I do. Oh, and by the way, we're going to do this thing called lockdowns. You're not going to be able to go to work. People are going to, instead of getting a wage, the government is going to give them furlough and all of the other things. Now, just imagine you had lived through that era. Or just imagine that COVID-19 had happened, where there was no mass media, no newspapers, no BBC, no social media. Would you have experienced a pandemic? Would you have known it was happening? Did it really take place? I don't know. It certainly happened as a massive media spectacle. I remember people arguing about it on TV. I remember Piers Morgan telling everybody, we have to lock down now. How can you still be right? I remember all of it. I remember mass hysteria. I remember on Thursday nights going outside and everybody had to clap in the street for our NHS. I remember it all. This was a spectacle. It was, in some ways, an event that could only have taken place in the era of mass media. And this really is what Guy Debord is talking about. What was your direct experience? Maybe some of you had, you know, got COVID or had it. But for many, many millions of people, their experience of COVID would have been all that stuff. How did we experience that stuff? Well, first and foremost, it was through the images and appearances that we were given on television. While I'm on this subject, before I continue, I think it's important to hammer home just how many things, events, take place simply because we've seen them on television. The death of Princess Diana was an event that people still talk about now because there was such hysteria around it. Well, who was Princess Diana? Why did anybody care that she had died? Why were people buying armfuls of Elton John CDs? Why were people literally crying? Why did the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, give a speech saying, the princess of our hearts? This was another event that was almost exclusively a media event. We experienced it, first and foremost, only as media. And in fact, I would say it was almost 100% a media event, because the number of people who actually knew Princess Diana was probably, you know, like directly, you know, actually knew her in her life. It was probably, what, like 100 people or something? Let's just say it was 1,000. Still, it would not have justified all of the furore that was around it. But then if you really start to think about this, you can go even further. You know, around that same time, there was a number of wars that took place. There was the war in Bosnia. Britain was at war. You know, it was involved in Kosovo as well under Tony Blair. And then later it was involved in Afghanistan and Iraq. And huge thing that happened was 9/11. Everybody remembers watching it on their TV screens. And it was a huge spectacle. In fact, I'll never forget the day it happened because I was really excited. I was a huge Bob Dylan fan. And he had a new album out that day. It was called Love and Theft. Still a brilliant album. And my buddy had come round and we were going to listen to the album together, me and this fellow Dylan aficionado. Instead, our planned day had been ruined because 9/11 happened. So we literally just spent the day watching the footage over and over again like that. Oh my God, what's happened? Things are never going to be the same again. But, okay, unless you were actually in the Twin Towers that day, unless you were actually in the Bosnian War, the Kosovo War, the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, your sole experience of it was through the media. In fact, you experienced all of those things, as terrible as 9/11 was, as terrible as though all those wars were, you experienced them only as spectacle. And this is why I'm saying, so I'm stressing this before I get into the rest of the board, how important it is to realize the number of things that you only experience because of mass media. I have a distinct memory of experiencing 9/11. But at the end of the day, I was just watching TV. Of experiencing the death of Princess Diana. In fact, I remember exactly where I was. I was listening to talk radio at 4 a.m. I was probably one of the first people in the country to know because I was listening to Ian Collins and the Creatures of the Night or whoever it was. And I went down and I woke my mother up. And I said, Mum, Princess Diana's died. And she said, she died in a car crash. And she said, oh, don't be stupid. Just go back to sleep. What are you up for? But then, of course, when she woke up in the morning, it was like, and then I remember going to school and there was something weird that day. And that is the society of the spectacle. I experienced it as a real life event, even though I had absolutely nothing to do with it. 100% media. Okay, I think the point is proven. Let us move on with the board. So, the spectacle is a social relation among people mediated by images rather than a collection of images. It functions as the official language of the existing order, justifying the current system while isolating individuals from genuine collective action. So all of these images that you're given, right, all of these various images that are coming in all of the time, basically function to keep you to draw an Althusser as an ideological capital S subject of the current status quo. And if you think about it, all of these things, the death of Princess Diana, 9/11, Iraq War, all of them were designed. I mean, they weren't COVID, right? That I just talked about. All of them had a kind of social use for power. Capital P power for the order, right? All of them had a use. And the upshot was that you as an individual you're not becoming an organized minority. You're in fact just encouraged to get in line. What was the actual upshot of all of these things? It was, you know, if we go through them, it was increased security. You know, in America, it was the Patriot Act. That was the ultimate down the line of, you know, it was extra security at airports and things like that. And, of course, because we had all witnessed 9/11, we all then were like, well, that's justified. We need to give the government these extra powers. And, you know, if you ever get into these, if you've ever spent any time as a civic libertarian, you will get into arguments with people who say, well, look, I actually want the state to have these powers. And if you don't, like, what have you got to hide? What have you got to hide? You know, I've done nothing wrong, I've nothing to hide. That's the argument that is always used, because ultimately these are arguments, you know, for maintaining social and political order on behalf of the current ruling class. And so Du Bois is, you know, as a kind of revolutionary left-wing thinker, Du Bois has got, you know, he's always got his eye on the prize, which is revolutionary political action. He's saying that this is basically impossible under these sorts of circumstances, because everybody is just dizzied, really, by these narratives of spectacle. You know, I have a couple of buddies, Scrump and Evelyn. The channel is called Scrump Monkey. They do a lot of work on this sort of narrative building by the sources of officialdom and by the mass media. They recently did a stream on various uses of narrative, the murder of Anne Whittacombe, for example, the change in prime minister from Keir Starmer to Andy Burnham. And they do a very, I mean, I would argue, you could argue their analysis is Du Boisian, right? They recognize the uses of spectacle for power, that, you know, because, you know, we liked Anne Whittacombe, we saw her on Strictly Come Dancing, because there has been this murder, therefore now we support, every politician supports, every person supports extra security being laid on for the political class. Right, it's basically the political class saying we need extra guards because of what's happened to Anne Whittacombe. And everybody else sitting there says, oh, of course you should. Yeah, it was terrible what happened to Anne Whittacombe. Yeah, absolutely give yourselves extra security forces. Or in America, the assassination attempts on Donald Trump, therefore justify extra security being laid on for the president, yada, yada, yada. Or on the other side, when it was January the 6th, right, the so-called insurrection. Do you remember when they put all of the fencing around the White House and around the Congress? Do you remember that? And many people on there said, well, of course, this is justified. We must keep Nancy Pelosi safe. This is our sacred temple. This is our democracy. And the board would say, all of this nonsense is spectacle designed to keep you in a permanent state of dizziness so that you continually acquiesce to giving more and more powers to the security state. So what Scrump and Evelyn talk about every week. So if you don't watch them, check them out, right? It does require some kind of self-control. Some people are impulsive, don't disagree with their lifestyle choices and so on. But, you know, in a way, that's to get caught up in spectacle as well. Anyway, let's carry on. So early capitalism focused on the production of goods. Value resided in use and exchange. This is your kind of classic. This is, you know, right? It's not Karl Menger's capitalism anymore, right? This is like Adam Smith capitalism. Advanced capitalism then focused on the production of appearances. The commodity in itself becomes the image. A couple of weeks back, I did a video which more people should have watched. I was disappointed. You know, I've been really happy with the views on this Great Thinkers series. But the video on Edward Bernays, I think, was underviewed. And that was a really important one to watch. So if you're watching this one, go back and watch Edward Bernays, because really what Du Bois is doing is he's saying, like, capitalism has been Bernaysized. It's now all about propaganda. It's now all about weaving the dreams of the consumerist masses with these invisible dictators like Bernays. What matters is no longer the use value, but rather how things appear. and what they signal. What they signal. De Boer's analysis extends Marx's political economy into the realm of representation itself. He says this is a decisive shift in capitalism's logic. So you can see why I'm interested in De Boer, how this fits with some of the thinkers like Althusser I've talked about, and people like Edward Bernays or Walter Lippmann. They're all talking about the same thing from slightly different angles. And, you know, you will see De Boer talked about as a Marxist or as a left winger or as a postmodern thinker. And many people say, well, because I come from this tradition, because I'm a libertarian or because I'm a conservative, I don't want to touch this kind of stinky leftist. I have never thought like that at all. I think interesting thinkers have things of real value to say. And De Boer clearly was onto something with this idea. The spectator here is a passive subject. Under the spectacle, the individual is reduced to a spectator of their own life. Experience is replaced by the contemplation of images of experience. People no longer live, they watch representations of living, and in doing so, lose the capacity for autonomous action and critical thought. Now, De Boer wrote this book in the 60s, right? So he really had, you know, mass media and television in mind. Obviously, now we live in the age of the smartphone and of social media. But how many times have you been out and about? Okay. And again, I'll bring my screen up because a couple of years back, I went on a stag do, which means I got to experience the hoi polloi that I wouldn't usually come across. I remember there was this day where we went and we went to this pool. Okay, we were in Spain and we went next to this pool and we hung out there with drinks. Okay, so there are all these, and I had never seen this before, this spectacle of girls, young ladies, who would dress themselves up to the nines, right? They'd have shades on and they'd have the kind of tight-fitting dresses and so on. They'd go along to this pool where there were these kind of, loungers and things around and people having drinks. They'd go along to the pool with their smartphone. And basically their whole thing was they do that kind of fish face thing and pause for a selfie. Maybe somebody would take some photographs of them doing various poses in front of this pool, and then that was it. They bugger off again. Okay, they weren't there to party, they weren't there to swim in the pool, they weren't there to drink. It seems like they went there exclusively to pose. And I was like, this is a weird thing. I've never seen this thing before. And then I thought, well, maybe this girl's a model. Maybe she's some Instagram model or something. And it's just, but then it's like, okay, now there's another group of girls doing it. Now there's another group. So eventually, I actually went over there. I said, can I just ask, what are you guys actually doing? She was like, oh, we're all out on a hen do. So like, oh, that's funny. I'm out on a stag do. What are you like? I've seen various people come along, go to the pool, take a couple of selfies, then go again. What are you doing? You're not having a drink. You're not in the pool. You're like, what is this? And you're like, yeah, that's what we do now. That's what we do. And I would say this is the kind of the kind of end point, really, of not actually living to live, but living for the representation of the thing. These girls were not actually hanging out by the pool. They weren't actually there having fun. They were basically living the representation of having fun. I mentioned it before when I saw the students at the gates of on the logo of the university there. You know, they were all there doing the communist fist, okay, as if they were revolutionaries, as if they were engaged in revolutionary struggle. posing there, revolutionary struggle in one hand, little manga thing on the other hand, taking selfies, and they're one of those long selfie sticks posing for the revolutionary struggle. The board would say, this is nothing about this is real. These students or these girls at the pool had been reduced to passive subjects in their own lives, merely playing out the representations of what they think they should be doing that they've seen on media or social media. The spectacle produces a false unity. It presents society as a harmonious whole while intensifying separation between people and their own activities, and between people and the world. Everyone is connected through the same images, yet profoundly isolated in their private consumption of those images. So on the one hand, you're being invited, and I've always thought that in this country, it is particularly insidious in the BBC, right? The BBC has always cultivated an image of itself as being warm and cozy, as being auntie. They call themselves auntie. Well, we're auntie, it's auntie. And it's become worse at this over time, I would argue. I would say the peak of this was when I was, in the 80s and the 90s, when I was a kid. And it was kind of a avuncular figure, like Terry Wogan. Terry Wogan in a little knitted jumper, with his calm, lilting Irish tones. He's like, oh, come on, grab yourself a hot chocolate and settle down. Come and join Auntie. So you're then invited to think of yourself as part of this fictional collective, which is essentially just the audience of the BBC. But of course, you're just sitting there alone. You don't actually know anybody else. You're not actually having a collective communal experience. Nothing about it is authentic. You don't know Terry Wogan. And yet you're being kind of lulled into this sense that you're part of this bigger thing. Now, I would argue that, again, the board's analysis can be extended into the social media age, that there's a little bit more of increased interactivity on social media. If you're watching this YouTube channel, you may sense that you know me in some way, even though we've never met, because you've spent hours listening to me. They call this a parasocial relationship. And you may then comment under the video and I might comment back to you. Or, Twitter's even worse for it, right? Because Twitter's all about that. It's just the comment, essentially. And then it kind of lulls you into thinking that you're part of this bigger thing. Whereas, in fact, you're still just one of these individual nodes that you can see in the diagram there. Shared images and mass culture create an illusion of togetherness. Whereas really what's happening is that you're just alone with a screen. Individual isolation suppresses solidarity. And what's even more insidious is that social media creates moments of faux solidarity that lead people to think that they are actually taking political action, when in fact it's just this again. Let me give you an example. The assassination of Charlie Kirk that happened just last year. Well, we were told this is it. This is the real moment. Conservatives will have no more of this. It was a quote unquote coming together. It was this big event. Did it produce political action? Did it produce change? Did it produce genuine solidarity? Did it produce togetherness? Or simply the illusion of those things? It was a massive spectacle. It was a massive media event. I'll never forget that the absurdity where this bloke in London, who was a pub owner, decided to turn his pub into a Charlie Kirk pub. Can you think of anything more detached? Like, this is that brings the absurdity of it into real life. Sitting there on your computer, just like people were crying at the death of Princess Diana, you convinced yourself that you really cared for Charlie Kirk, that this meant something to you, that he was important for the quote-unquote movement, whatever the hell that is. But when that guy opened up a Charlie Kirk pub in London, I couldn't help but think that the absurdity of that illusion was then shattered into a million pieces because it could not survive contact with reality. I wonder if the Charlie Kirk pub is still there, by the way. It's July 2026, about 1 year later. Marx described commodity fetishism as social relations between people appearing as relations between things. Debord argues that in the spectacle, this process reaches completion. Social relations now appear as relations between images. The image of the commodity becomes more real and more desirable than the commodity itself. And again, I'll go back to the example I gave in Bernays. The image of the Coca-Cola is more real than the Coke itself. It's the dream. It's the dream of the Coke. The trappings of it. The image of it, you could say, rather than the actual drink itself. And yet here I am, what a mug, still drinking it. Sorry, Debord, I'm a product of my age. The colonization of time. Lived time is eliminated. Genuine temporal experience shaped by collective memory, anticipation, and historical becoming is suppressed. This is real, authentic experience. Now, recently, over on the Academic Agent Mindset channel, I released a video on awareness and presence. And in that video, I gave five or six exercises to increase your awareness of the world around you and to be what they call fully present in the moment. Why is this such a struggle for me and lots of other people in the modern world? It is a struggle because we have been bombarded and we live in the age, the society of spectacle. There is a pseudo-cyclical time replaced by managed rhythm of consumption, of leisure, and of programmed events. Time in itself becomes a spectacle by which we demarcate. You know, I think of the World Cup. It was the World Cup earlier this summer. That comes up once every 4 years. It's a big spectacle, right? These are the sorts of things he has in mind. History is frozen. The possibility of real historical change is obscured. The present becomes perpetual and inevitable. The internet meme version of what Debord is saying is nothing ever happens. And I've said it before, a nuclear bomb could go off. If the net result of that nuclear bomb is Piers Morgan talking to Candice Owens, okay, on a YouTube video where their faces are just shouting, right? I mean, the new hell of the Piers Morgan, you know, it's Piers Morgan. Everybody's just shouting with a tank and whatever else, and they're all shouting about something. That shows you nothing is happening. Another thinker we might look at some point is Fernand Braudel. He had this concept called the longue durée, that, you know, if the rhythms of everyday life are not disturbed for the average person, then nothing has actually happened. What's particularly interesting about the society of the spectacle is that the spectacles in themselves dictate those rhythms. They actually dictate those rhythms, if you think about it. they punctuate all of the little parts of life. You know, think about the television season, for example, the football season, whatever it happens to be. These are things kind of external being dictated to you by mass media. And like I say, I'm very much a child of this era, right? And I can remember when I was growing up, I always had the Radio Times, the TV Times, whatever it was, and I would make a habit of planning my activities around the TV guide. I would go through and I would circle the shows I really wanted to watch. People came to call on me. I'd say, look, I can't come out now. I'm watching this. It's Thursday. That means I watch this show. And you know, back then, obviously you could tape things and so on, but it was a bit of a to-do. So it was like, well, I needed to catch the show. So you could see how the spectacle, in a strange way, was dictating what I actually did more than my actual life. Right? And the thing about De Bord is that he's not saying this as a kind of moral judgment on any person who's grew up in this. He's saying this is the condition in which we all find ourselves. This is what is inculcated in us by living in a capitalist system. And it's extremely hard, if not impossible, to break out of. Because this is, quote unquote, reality. And you can see how this plugs into Walter Lippmann, for example, who talked about the pseudo-reality. De Bord is talking about the pseudo-reality. Against the spectacle, De Bord and the Situationists proposed the construction of situations, that is, deliberately created moments of authentic, collective, lived experience that rupture passive contemplation. These situations were experimental, playful, and disruptive of everyday alienation. Okay, so they, you know, and this is really where a lot of those, again, I can't lie, I find some of these things a little bit irritating, but everybody's seen these kind of groups that go out there and do, you know, little public stunts to disrupt the flow of everyday life. This is the sort of thing De Bord had in mind. I think a lot of people find that irritating as well, to be frank. But he was trying to find something to get through, something that's real, something that's authentic. He developed the concept of détournement, which is the hijacking and subversive reuse of existing cultural materials, that is, advertising, film, slogans, artworks. And these materials are then made to turn against their original meaning and reveal the domination hidden within them. It transforms the spectacle's own language into a weapon of critique. Now, as with so many things, almost everything really, the left got there first. The left got there when De Bord wrote this book, and they did all this stuff in the 60s and the 70s. The right got there many, many years later, you know, in the age of the internet. You know, the right would call this culture jacking. They called it culture jacking. And there are lots of kind of quite cringeworthy attempts at this. I remember a while back, the British government released this character called Amelia, who was, you know, politically correct and a feminist and all these sorts of things. And then the quote-unquote online right captured Amelia, turned her into a meme, into a kind of anti-immigration, nationalistic, kind of, you know, chauvinistic, a bit kind of British chauvinist, and thereby claimed Amelia against, right, they used it again. That is exactly what De Bord is talking about. I happen to think that a lot of these techniques now are somewhat played out, that, you know, after I think the system actually is more adept at dealing with this sort of play than the board maybe gave it credit for. Or if it wasn't back then, certainly it's smartened up to it now, because also we live in a post the board world as well. Everybody's read this book. Everybody knows these tactics. So that, you know, as with everything, if you imagine the left are the early adopters, the right kind of are the laggards who pick it up just when the thing is dying on its ass. That's really what the online right is. The kind of, you know, right wing pastiche of what the left wing radical was back in the 60s or something like that. Maybe I'm being a little bit harsh. Maybe I'm not. Okay. The reclamation of life. The ultimate aim goes beyond cultural critique. It is the replication, the reclamation of everyday life itself. The spectacle must be abolished so that people can live directly, that communicate without mediation by images, and collectively shape their own existence rather than consuming representations of it. The ultimate goal is to abolish the spectacle, the end of the domination of images over lived experience. Unmediated communication, restore direct, authentic relations between people. Go to the pub, in other words. Go and just go out in everyday life. Stop talking on social media. Stop being on the internet. Go out there in the real world. And it's funny because at this point, the left was all for these ideas. But fast forward to, you know, Britain in the 2020s, and the government's actually the leftist has actually been captured now by the spectacle, so that there is no more obedient foot soldier for the regime than exactly the people that de Boer would have wanted fighting the regime. That is how good the system is at containment. They have become the flag bearers for spectacle. The left. It's a tragedy from a left-wing point of view. It is an absolute tragedy what has become of the left, because they have become the spectacle themselves. Finally, there is collective self-determination. Ideally, the political radical should shape existence through action and not through passive media consumption. Get out there and do things, is what de Boer was trying to say. Get out there and live your life. And that is really it. Those are the 10 points. Now, forgive me if I got a little bit on my soapbox today, friends. But these points that all this week I'm going to be talking about postmodernism, living in the mask in the age of mass communication, and also tomorrow I'm going to talk about Baudrillard and hyper-reality. This is quite a big theme in a lot of my work. If you've picked up Applied Elite Theory, it starts with the Boomer Truth Regime essay for the book that I never actually wrote. And a lot of this material informs the analysis. In fact, I made a whole series of videos years ago that are now together in one big video called The Boomer Truth Regime. And this really is the postmodern lens turned back on our own society, you know, viewed from, you might say, you know, a critical lens or a right critical lens. But essentially what I was engaged in is using the tools of postmodernism, of using the tools of de Boer and Baudrillard and Foucault and all of these other thinkers that I'm going to be talking about this week, Frederick Jameson, and saying, look, the left, they had all of this stuff. They were given all of these tools and they squandered them because they stopped asking questions. They stopped actually critiquing, right? They failed to recognize the elements of themselves that had been in power and how their own ideas had been co-opted by universities and the court and the forces of officialdom and by capitalism. They failed to recognize that. and in so doing, got lazy. Instead of applying these tools, updating them, turning them back on to the current power structure, they instead opted to become part of the power structure and simply, as I've said before, endlessly deconstruct the 1950s, who is propped up like El Cid on his horse, straw man, just to be knocked down again. Oh, it's the patriarchal 1950s again and again and again. Why do they keep on going back there? Because de Bord and Althusser and Foucault and Roland Barthes, they were around then. That was the society they were critiquing. We live in a society now that has already been deconstructed, that has already had all this stuff go through it. And yet, they do not recognize how they were co-opted, the left, overall. Maybe some of the cleverer parts of the left do. And so, in some ways, this boomer truth stuff that I've talked about is really what left-wingers should be doing too. But left-wingers have become cowardly. They have become co-opted, and they have become, to come back to the board, part of the spectacle, part of the uses of spectacle all around them. So that is why I've been so critical of the left, but also why I am happy to draw on their tools. Also why I was a little bit more lively in today's lecture. Tomorrow we'll be doing Baudrillard. All this week is going to be postmodernism. It's going to be hyperreality. We're going to talk about Lyotard. We're going to talk about Jameson. It's going to be fantastic. Pick up a course at the Academic Agency, and I'll see you all tomorrow. Bye, everyone.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.